I'm pleased today to be able to introduce an old friend of mine as a speaker today. I was thinking about how I would introduce him, how I would gather the data, but I just got an email the other day that did my work for me, that had this was for your collective action or your group agency. And I had this long description of you. You should announce that today, because I'm looking forward to that. Anyway, so it already had this description of everything he does. So I'll read out bits of it, because it's too elaborate for me to remember. He's Chauncey Stillman Professor of Practical Ethics in the Department of Philosophy and the Keenan Institute for Ethics at Duke University. He is core faculty in the Duke Institute for Brain Sciences, the Duke Center for Cognitive Neuroscience, and the Duke Center for Interdisciplinary Decision Sciences. And he also has official connections with University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, with something called the Mind Research Network in New Mexico, and also at the UHERO Center for Practical Ethics and also the UHERO Center for Neuroethics, both here in Oxford. In fact, he's around all the time, and we can scarcely get him to go home to North Carolina. And I know all those affiliations sound very impressive, but you see, I know Walter, and he's just an old boy from Memphis, Tennessee.
Yeah.
And all that stuff about minds, you know, that don't mean nothing. You can tell from the many affiliations that his work is extremely broad-ranging in ethics. He works in all the relevant areas. He works in meta-ethics, normative ethics, practical ethics, moral psychology, moral epistemology. Do you do any work in history of ethics?
Not really.
Okay, well, so he gets high marks anyway for ethics. He also works in a lot of other areas of philosophy and epistemology of the non-moral variety, philosophy of religion. He has a recent book called, it's hard to say the title of this book, it's Morality Without God? With a strike through of the bit that says Without God? So you figure it out. He works in experimental philosophy, neuroscience philosophical neuroscience, philosophy of law, informal logic, lots of other areas. We call that a dilettante. Today he's going to spread himself even thinner by presenting some of the ideas from a book he's writing, in which he develops what he calls a contrastivist view of responsibility and freedom. So take it away. And the way, I should announce, he's going to do something a little unusual. He's going to stop every 15 minutes and allow two people to ask questions at that point. He doesn't trust you to have the capacity to concentrate for more than 15 minutes at a time.
And I have evidence for that.
Yes, there'll be a demonstration. But we will then have, so the talk will last a little longer than usual because of these breaks. Then we'll have our customary break between the talk and the regular discussion. Then we will adjourn for those of you who want to accompany us for dinner at Somerville College.
Great. And I will be around for the whole term, so if any of you want to talk to me about any of that other stuff, you know, just let me know and we'll have lunch or something. That would be great. But I am going to talk about a new project today. I want to start by mentioning this. What we've got is a project starting at Duke next May, and you can apply for it for 2 weeks. The philosophers come and learn neuroscience, and the neuroscientists come and learn philosophy. And you join up in teams and design experiments, and we fund the best experiments. So it's a real opportunity to learn some neuroscience if you're interested in that. So I want to make sure everybody saw that. But today, I'm going to talk about mental causation and moral responsibility. I'm actually at the Martin School, so that's where you'd go to meet me if you want to drop by and talk. As Jeff said, this is part of a larger project on a book on free will and moral responsibility. I really think there are two challenges that arise that the book's going to focus on. The first one has to do with, does anything cause the will? This is the problem of determinism. do the physical states or the social circumstances or psychological states make it inevitable that you're going to act the way that you do, and does that rob you of freedom and responsibility? But there's a completely separate challenge that we need to separate from this, which is the problem of, does the will cause anything? Because if your will is free, in the sense of uncaused, or even you control it, but it doesn't do anything, it doesn't actually affect the way your body moves, then you can't be responsible either. Because you didn't control how your body moved, even if you did control what you chose. So the old challenge of determinism I've talked about here before, although over in the old place. Here the debate is between incompatibilists and compatibilists who think that determinism is incompatible with free will and responsibility, or it's compatible. I'm just going to tell you what my view is, because my last talk to the philosophers at Oxford outlined all this, but I thought I'd mention it. I think there are just two notions of freedom. One is freedom in contrast with causation. Another is freedom in contrast with constraint. Freedom in contrast with causation is not compatible with determinism. It's incompatible. Whereas freedom in contrast with constraint is compatible. And I think both those notions are perfectly good, and there's no reason to prefer one over the other. We just got to keep them straight and then say different things about them. I developed that view in a recent article in a collection by Martin Blau called Contrastivism in Philosophy. I wanted to mention it here just to get it out of the way, to make it absolutely clear that everybody understands I'm not talking about determinism, okay? That's not the issue. What I'm going to talk about is the challenge of epiphenomenalism. Nietzsche put it this way: the inner world is full of phantoms and will-o'-the-wisps. The will is one of them. The will no longer moves anything, hence does not explain anything either. It merely accompanies events. Well, if it doesn't move anything, if my choice to move my hand from left to right or from your right to your left does not result in my hand moving, then it's hard to see how I could be responsible. And so that's a challenge to freedom and responsibility. It's not really a challenge to freedom. It's a challenge to your will being efficacious or potent as opposed to impotent. So why does this impotence matter? Well, if causation by conscious will is necessary for full responsibility, I think there are degrees, but we're just going to talk about full responsibility here. And if neuroscience rules out causation by conscious will, then neuroscience rules out completely responsibility. I'm just going to focus on neuroscience because that's the particular angle that interests me, but other types of causes could be filled in place of neuroscience. Okay? So the first question we have to ask is causation by conscious will necessary for full responsibility? Namely, is the if clause true? One bit of evidence that it's true, and I hear appeal to U.S. law simply because I know it. I forgot to mention I'm in the law school at Duke, too. You have to add that because that gives you authority when you cite the law, right? But here's what the law actually says. The Model Penal Code, passed in the late 50s, instituted in most states with slight variations throughout the U.S., and my understanding of English law is that it's approximately the same. It has similar requirements in it. Most modern legal systems do. And what it says is that a person is not guilty of an offense unless his liability is based on conduct that includes a voluntary act. It's not that every feature has to be voluntary, but it has to include a voluntary act. And this is what lawyers do. They don't tell you what a voluntary act is. They tell you what it's not, right? And they say in particular, it's not a bodily movement that otherwise is not a product of the effort or determination of the actor, either conscious or habitual. Now notice what that means. If you take not a product means it's not caused by, an effort or determination is just their word for will, then if it's not caused by a conscious will, you're not responsible. Okay? Now this is legal doctrine in the vast majority of states in the U.S. There are a few exceptions. I believe it's in England as well. If anybody knows otherwise, please let me know. And the fact that it's so widespread suggests that there's at least some common intuition behind it. Now, to bring out that common intuition, I'm just going to mention one case. There are lots of others. We could go on this, but I'm trying here to motivate why we should be interested in this question of mental causation. So I should say, I used to teach at Dartmouth, and I lived like on the main road in Dartmouth. And just about maybe 50 feet from my breakfast window, we had this breakfast room, and it had a big picture window that looked out on the street. There were these kids that jogged by every morning. It's just so annoying because they were my students and they waved to me and I go, I'm having breakfast with my kids, like, leave me alone. And so I really developed this intense hatred of these kids. So I decided that I wanted to kill them. And I would kill them because I knew they always came by at exactly 9 o'clock in the morning. Or it's not me. Let's change it. It's not me. This is not true. Okay. Someone plans to kill somebody they don't like by running them over at 9 o'clock. And it's 9 o'clock now, but the person thinks it's 8 o'clock because they forgot to change their clock for daylight saving time. And so they decide to go out and buy breakfast. And as they pull out of their driveway, they run over and kill those joggers by accident. So what is this example? Notice what happens is the driver had a will, had made a choice to kill them, and made a choice to kill them at 9 o'clock by running them over with their car at the mouth of the driveway. And at 9 o'clock, they did run them over with their car at 9 o'clock, you know, at the mouth of the driveway. So they did exactly what they willed to do at a time when they had that will. But are they responsible for murder? Well, again, my intuition and the law would say no. They may be responsible for reckless driving, but not for murder. Because, why? Because the driver's will did not cause the accident. What caused the accident was the desire to go buy breakfast, not the desire to kill the jogger. And so it turns out that in order to be fully responsible, it's not enough to have a will to do the thing that you're doing, or for that will to be a malicious will to do something bad. There has to be a causal relation between the will and the motion, or the person is not fully responsible. That is for murder. Of course, you could still be responsible for reckless driving, but we're talking about murder here. So this is the first point at which I'm going to stop and say I'll take like a question or two if there are any. If not, I'll go on. But I don't think people can concentrate for an hour, so I'm giving you your chance. Yeah?
So in one of the slides, you said that if neuroscience rules out the possibility of the will being causally efficacious, then that rules out complete moral responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So why complete? Why that qualifier? Why would not rule out?
To make it, to make it clearer. It might, rule out, even partial, but I want to look at just the claim that we're talking about complete moral responsibility, the level of responsibility that would be required for the maximum punishment. Just to simplify it, because if you get degrees in there, it just complicates things. I'm really just trying to simplify it. If it makes a difference, though, at any point, let me know. Yep?
This may be unfair because it may involve too many questions about the nature of causation and causal relations. But
which is what we're going to talk about.
So suppose that the reason I'm running out to get breakfast at 8 o'clock is because I'm determined to get back by 9 o'clock to kill the jogger. Right? So then there might be a less direct causal chain between the will and...
Sure. So you're absolutely right. I should fix the example up so that the person always goes and gets breakfast at 8 o'clock, and so it has nothing to do with the jogging and so on. Okay, that was two. Okay, the next question then is the and if part. Does neuroscience rule out causation by conscious will? That's what we want to talk about. And the challenge, actually I say the first challenge, but I don't think we're going to get to the second challenge. I think we're only going to talk about the first challenge. Cognitive neuroscientists seek electrochemical explanations of neural events. But if those electrochemical explanations do not refer to any mental state, much less any conscious mental state. So here's an example. What you've got is a monkey down here. This is the Newsom-Shadlin drift diffusion model, for those who know it. and you put a monkey in front, and you've got this little circle up here. I should have a pointer. Got a little circle up there. And what happens is the dots move in random ways back and forth, but there's a slight drift to the left or drift to the right, and that in this little circle. And they're either drifting this way or they're drifting that way. And you can change the amount of coherence, whether it's 5% that way, which would be like 55% that way and 45% that way, or it could be, you know, like 70% that way and 30% that way. And the monkey has to detect which way they're drifting, and if they're drifting to the right, then he simply takes his eyes and saccades to the right and he gets a squirt of juice. And the monkeys can get really good at this, and they can actually, you know, put a little thing up at the top where if they're not sure, they can go up there. And then they get one squirt, but if they get it right, they get two squirts. And I mean, this has been used in hundreds and hundreds of experiments. What matters here is that they can actually take the activation of the neurons in LIP and predict exactly when the monkey's going to saccade its eyes. So you get a certain buildup as the percentage goes. It takes longer when it's 5% than when it's 15% than when it's 30%. But once the activation of the neurons passes a certain threshold, bam, the eyes turn to the right or to the left, depending on the pattern of firing in the neurons. And they can actually take, you know, the neuron firings and say, when the neurons are firing in according to this pattern, you know, the eyes will move to the right. Now notice, no mention of any mental state. It's just an example of how a neuroscientist can look only at the firings of neurons and the movement of the eyes, whereas what's happening is the monkey is choosing to go to the right in order to get juice, right? This is called a decision-making paradigm, and they all talk about it as decision-making, but the predictions don't depend on that. So it looks like what the neuroscientist is doing is simply referring to electrochemical events in the brain in order to predict and claim a cause of the act and explain it. So if neuroscientists, I mean, obviously that's monkeys, but I don't think we're that different from monkeys. You know, we are different from monkeys, but in this respect, in this particular way, we're similar to monkeys. They're obviously a lot more complicated because we have top-down cognition that affects our action in many ways. But that's just going to complicate the number of neurons you have to look at. It's not going to change the overall lesson. So if neuroscientists can explain all acts, then conscious will is not necessary to explain or to cause any act, right? It's not necessary because the whole thing works without ever mentioning any conscious cognitive state at all. Okay? So maybe it's sufficient. And now we've got to look at a philosophical argument, a well-known philosophical argument, Jagmond Kim's exclusion argument. Okay? So but this is just the basic diagram where M stands for mental states or events and P stands for mental states, events, or properties. Different people interpret the variables different ways. For what I'm saying, I don't think it's going to matter, although I'll get into some more detail later. The basic picture is that if the physical event causes, that every mental state has to be realized in a particular physical state, right? So if you have two mental states that follow each other, then they have to be realized in different physical states. And if the physical state causes the physical state, then what do you need the mental state for, right? If you think every physical event has a physical cause, then you don't need the mental. And in fact, if you also had a mental cause, it'd be kind of redundant. It would be like two people shooting the same person in a firing squad. It will be overdetermination, but that's not the way you think of it because the two shooters in the firing squad are independent of each other, whereas the mental state and the physical state, one supervenes on the other. So it's not true overdetermination. So it doesn't seem they should both be sufficient. They also, it doesn't seem like it's necessary because this would have been sufficient to bring it about. That's the puzzle. More formally, Kim lays it out with five propositions. The first is closure of the physical, which says that every physical event has a sufficient physical cause. Okay? If that weren't true, then there would be magic in the world, right? Things would just happen. Now, you can you change this. Every physical that has any sufficient cause has a sufficient physical. That's just a handle quantum mechanics if there are certain physical states in quantum mechanics that aren't caused. But it's not going to that's not going to affect the argument here. Irreducibility. This argument is aimed at a particular version of physicalism, namely non-reductive physicalism. If every mental event is distinct from, this, by the way, was why I put the not equal sign there, because it's not reducible to it. Okay. Following Kim, he does the same thing. Supervenience says every mental property is realized or instantiated in some physical property, such that necessarily anything with that physical property has the mental property, but not conversely. That's just what supervenience means in this context. There are many different meanings of supervenience. That's what it means here. Okay. Now, here's Kim's exclusion principle, which is what we're going to have to focus on. If a physical event has a sufficient physical cause, it does not have any distinct sufficient cause, distinct from that physical cause, at the same time. You know, it might have a chain of physical causes, but at the same time, it doesn't have another one, except in cases of overdetermination, and this, the mental causing the physical is not that. Now, if you think this through, it means it's got to have a physical cause. If it's got a physical cause, it doesn't have a distinct sufficient cause, but if it had a mental cause, it would be distinct. You know, and you think it through, you can't have all five of these, right? You're gonna have a contradiction. Okay? This is Kim's exclusion argument. I suspect that it's familiar to many of you. Okay? I'm going to give people a little minute to look at that. But we can come back to it. I just want to say, first of all, it's not a problem for dualists because they reject closure, that first principle, right? It's not a problem for reductive physicalists because they reject irreducibility, the second one. So it's really only a problem for non-reductive physicalists, people who want to be physicalists and accept closure, but want to be non-reductive physicalists and accept the second principle, irreducibility. And what Kim is trying to do is to argue that that view is unstable. And so at times in his career, he said, and therefore we ought to be reductive physicalists. Right? And other people have drawn that conclusion as well. Okay? Now, are there any questions about that? Yeah?
Yeah, so I'm not sure if I don't understand what you mean. I'm not sure if I understand what you mean by the will and the conscious will. I mean, is it just a collection of...
If you don't like the word the will, just choice. I choose to move my hand from left to right, from my... here. I choose to move my hand from left to right. I will to move my hand from left to right.
It's something that
the
happens.
Will is the choice that causes. Like, I choose to go left to right instead of right to left.
And choice is a mental event.
So it's a mental event. Okay. Yes, exactly. Yep.
Bodily movements or what goes in the term act?
Absolutely, it's bodily movements because, I mean, they're moving, like in the monkey case, it's the saccade of the eyes to the right or to the left, and they're studying which neural events cause that.
Yeah.
But they will often describe those as well as mental.
Yeah.
You know, they'll say the monkey chose to move the eyes to the right, and we're studying decision making. And so when you get into cognitive neuroscience as opposed to neurobiology, then you're studying mental events as well and trying to study the relation between them. Okay? One more.
Oh,
yeah.
Thank you. Still a question. I'm not sure whether this is a dualist comment, but I was curious whether just maybe the burden you put on yourself of saying that the mental is somewhere related to the physical is too much or kind of too much asked from the whole question, in the sense that the mental can be something like a useful myth, like the responsibility or the idea of responsibility or that we have behind, just that maybe something that we construct in a certain way.
It could be. I'm going to try to show it's not. Because I'm going to try to show it has causal efficacy. It really does make a difference in the world. And if it has causal efficacy, then it's not a myth. Right? Okay. If it has causal efficacy in the way that I'm going to say. I mean, obviously, myths has causal efficacy in other ways. Yeah. Okay. Now, the standard solution, I call this the standard solution. There are others, but this is the one that I think most philosophers have thought is most plausible. At least I think it's most plausible, refers in particular to the phenomenon of multiple realizability. So just to give you a kind of a day-to-day example of multiple realizability, think about money. Okay, a dollar is an abstract functional thing, right? It's not a physical thing. Now, quarters are physical things. Dimes are physical things. Now, they've got to have certain histories to be real quarters and so on. But, you know, this is a quarter, right? No, that's a quarter. Sorry. That's a dime. Sorry, got that wrong. And yet you go, which is a dollar? Well, a dollar is the property that's shared between the two sets, right? Because a dollar, the abstract thing, can be realized either as four quarters or 10 dimes, or two quarters and five dimes, or a dollar bill, or in a lot of other ways. Okay? So, now, you say, could you loan me a dollar? I mean, over here, I'm sorry to use the American version, but I had the slides already made up with American. I was too lazy to use pounds. I hope that doesn't cause any problems. But say you say, I want to get a Coke out of this machine. Can you loan me? But I don't have any money. Can you loan me a dollar? And I pull out my change, and I've got 10 dimes and four quarters. And I say, here, you know, I'm going to give you the four quarters. And you go, thanks. And then you're happy. And it has implications for our relationship or whatever. Now, the question is, what is it that caused him to say thank you and to be happy? I say to say thank you because that's a physical event. To be happy, that's a mental state. Okay? So what is it that caused him? You could say it's what caused it is the fact that I gave him four quarters. But actually, that's not right if you think about it. Because he would have been just as happy and would have also said thank you if I'd given him the 10 dimes. Wouldn't have made any difference to him because he's going to put him in the machine, right? He's not in a hurry, so going 10 times is not going to be a bother, right? And so he's going to be just as happy and just as thankful if I were to give him the 10 dimes instead of the four quarters. So it's not true that if I had not given him the four quarters, then he would not have said thank you. It's not true that if I had not given him the four quarters, he would not have been happy. Because if I had not given him the four, we're friends. I would have given him the 10 dimes. Right? So the nearest worlds are ones in which I would give him the 10 dimes instead of the four quarters, since we are friends, and that's all I had. And so, he would, if I had not given him the four quarters, he still would have been happy and thanked me. Okay? So, X causes Y only if X didn't occur, Y wouldn't occur. That's a standard counterfactual in dependency accounts of causation, but notice that's counterfactual is supposed to be true even on more productive or energy transfer views of causation. So this person would thank me if I didn't give you four quarters, because you would thank me if I gave you a dollar bill or 10 dimes or whatever, and you would not thank me if I did not give you a dollar in one form or another. So it looks like, given this, that the cause is the abstract thing, a dollar, the fact that I gave you a dollar. It's not the particular realization. That doesn't matter. So what people say is that this causal relation is not realization sensitive. It's realization insensitive. And so that suggests that what's really doing the causing is the abstract kind rather than the particular instantiation, which doesn't really matter. Now, the same thing applies in the mind. If the mind is similarly multiply realizable, and that's the next thing I'm going to talk about, but for now, just suppose that it is. Suppose a mental state like willing could be realized in different brain states, okay, along the same model. Then sometimes it's going to be the mental kind or mental description in terms of consciousness or will or some mental state that captures the relevant level of generality, just like dollar, the abstract kind, captured the relevant level of generality in that causal relation. So the mental state can capture the relevant level of generality for explaining an action. So let's suppose that Let's suppose that someone is going to take a shower and then all of a sudden she remembers the shower scene in Psycho. And she goes out and locks the door because she gets scared. Okay? Now, remembering the shower scene in Psycho can be realized in a number of different ways, in different neural patterns of firing, presumably in the hippocampus, but it doesn't matter. The details don't matter for our purposes. Which of those realizers occur doesn't matter, because either way she's going to feel fear and she's going to go lock the door. Okay? So that suggests that what's the thing... Well, let's see if I've got it on the next slide. I think I do. Yeah. So as long as I recall the shower scene, or she recalls the shower scene, then there's going to be increased blood flow in her amygdala, regardless of which specific brain state happens to realize that memory. And if there's blood flow in the amygdala and also neural firings in the amygdala, then that's going to be the fear, right? And so it's remembering the shower scene that causes that captures the right level of generality for explaining fear, because if that memory had been realized in a different way, she still would have felt fear. And then the fear causes the person to shake if you want an involuntary action, or to go lock the door if you want a voluntary action. And all of that gets caused by the memory, which is a mental event, remembering the shower scene. Okay? So all of that's assuming multiple realizability in the brain. I just want to quickly go through some evidence for multiple realizability. The easiest is we got two amygdalas, right? If you lose one of them, you can still feel fear. You lose the other one, you can still feel fear. So it turns out that your fear can be realized in the left amygdala or the right amygdala. That's multiple realizability already. People always say that's a cheap argument. I love cheap arguments. If they work, there's nothing better than a cheap argument. Okay, plasticity. You wouldn't believe how much people's brains can change and still have similar thoughts. This guy has ventricles. That's all just fluid. And yet, he graduated from college, got married, had a couple of kids, was reported to be a good parent until in his 40s he started to feel numbness in one of his legs, went to the doctor, and the doctor said, "Oh my God, look at that." Nobody even knew that that's what his brain looked like. So you can have extremely different brains functioning in very similar ways. Next, individual differences. Here are 9 people remembering the same thing under a scanner, same task, remembering a word under the similar circumstances, right? One of them, the main activity is up here, one it's here, one it's there, one it's here. Totally different places. So this looks like a memory of the word in this experimental situation can be realized in 9 different ways. And notice also that the average, the group average is over here, which means that most of them are abnormal. If normal means kind of like the average. Okay? And finally, the theory of brain that I prefer is this dynamic systems theory, which basically, I'll just tell you a little bit about it because it's relevant to one of the analyses later, that what happens is you have a group of neurons, say 10,000, and you have to have enough of them firing at a rate that is increased enough in order for a certain state to occur. And then, because they're all connected to certain other neurons, then you get enough activity in that neuron to fire, and that leads to something. But it doesn't matter which particular ones, but all that matters is that at least 1,000 of these 10,000 increase their firing rate by at least 30%, or an average of 30%, something like that. Then, bam, the other neuron is going to fire, and that's going to lead to effects. But it doesn't matter which one. So notice that's multiple realizability already. As Chimero and Silverstein say, key feature is that they allow one to abstract away from the causal, mechanical, and aggregate micro details to predict the behavior. Okay? You don't have to know which neuron is firing, you just have to know what percentage has increased its firing rate by how much. So then, if you have multiple realizability, that's going to show that the mental properties are not reducible, because if the same mental state could be realized in two physical states, it can't be identical to both of them because they're not identical. Okay? But then the mental properties can capture the right level of generality. As I said, it doesn't matter which of those 10,000 neurons is firing. What matters is that a certain percentage of them is firing, and that, you know, is what makes the causal difference. And in the shower scene, just to bring in the psychological terminology, it's the fear or the memory of the shower scene which causes the fear, which causes her to go lock the door or start shaking or whatever. Okay? So if they have to the right level of generality, then they can cause physical changes, and then our wills can cause our bodily movements. Okay? I say our actions, but our bodily movements is what I'm talking about. Bodily movements, I take it, are actions if they're intentional under some description. I'm an old Davidsonian. Okay? Any questions? Yep?
In relation to your earlier example of a coin.
Yes?
So, and the question of what makes your friend happy, and equally happy regardless of whether you gave him a coin or a quarter or quarters. Mm. Well, suppose you took a big hammer and just smashed the machine, gave him a drink, he would be as happy as he would have been if he had given him.
If you asked me for a dollar and I just smashed the machine and gave you, would you be happy?
Happy.
Really? I don't believe it. I think he would be unhappy because he's an honest guy and he also doesn't want to go to jail.
Okay, well, okay, let's stick just with your two examples and the question of what makes a person happy or more happy, less happy, what causes a person. Well, what causes a happiness is getting what you want. And in his case, what he wants is a drink.
Notice.
A dollar.
So that's interesting, because notice, he got happy before he ever got the drink. He said, oh, thank you.
Great, good. So it's the prospect of getting what you want,
yeah,
rather than getting a dollar bill or getting four,
yeah,
quarters bill. So that's what causes one's happiness.
Mm-hmm.
So really, what is the means to that end? It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So this is a straightforward answer.
So I think I agree with you, and I'm not sure why. Maybe I'm misunderstanding, but I don't see why that causes any problem for me, because I have, for example, me, you know, giving the four quarters, right, which is a dollar, and the question is, what causes him to say thank you? What causes those neurons to fire, to him to feel that his desires have been satisfied?
Mm-hmm.
The fact that I gave him a dollar. All those things are also caused. And if those are what you want to call happiness, that's fine.
Walter? Could I just... Oh, is there somebody else? I just wanted to briefly follow up that question, because I do think you could get exactly the same kind of reaction from the person by, instead of handing over a dollar in some way, you handed the drink itself, but that wouldn't be a one of the multiple.
Right, that would not make my point. That's why I didn't give that example. But my example still makes my point, even if that one wouldn't.
Okay.
I mean, that's the, right? I mean, I just have to show that mental can cause physical, and then an abstract thing like a dollar can cause. In some cases, it doesn't. But in other cases, it does. Yeah.
If you say that talking about the mental gets at the right level for explanation,
mm-hmm,
explanation, why don't you also say that action? action rather than physical movement gets you to the right level of what you're explaining.
For lack of time, I can't think of any other reason. I mean, I'm perfectly happy to say that action as opposed to physical movement. If by action you mean, you know, if physical movement is like the hand moves to the right, and the action is it moves to the right intentionally, something like that.
Well, I'm thinking also that at a certain level of action that can be multiply realizable in physical movement, so that the same argument seems to work on both sides of the...
I think this argument is all over the place. It also explains why biological kinds and life can have an effect when that is multiply realizable. I'll come back to, I think it shows how groups can be multiply, can be causally efficacious. I think it has a lot of applications, and that's one of them.
One point illustrating Jeff's anecdote is I was walking away from a restaurant with some leftover food in a bag, and a person asked if I had some spare change. And I said, no, but here's some food. And he said, thank you. Mm-hmm. So that means that the precision of what is asked for and what is the grounds for the thanks.
Absolutely.
Has a certain variability.
Right. And if he had been an alcoholic that really wanted to go spend the money on liquor, he would not have been happy. And so sometimes, you know, giving them a dollar fulfills their desires and makes them happy, and other times it doesn't. My argument is really just that abstract things can, in some cases, have causal efficacy. But notice, a dollar or a sandwich is also an abstract thing. And that's what made him happy.
What if there happened to be like a technical medical word in neuroscience that that described all the possible states in human brains that are remembering the shower scene in Psycho? Could you not then say that it was that state that caused
the disjunction?
Yeah,
absolutely. You could say that. It's just that that would have no role in physical science, in neuroscience. I mean, you can always disjoin and gerrymander and get that kind together and then say that's the one that does it. But it's not going to mean anything to neuroscience, right? Because they're looking at the individual neurons. So it's going to matter. It's going to be a matter of saying that the categories that play a role in neuroscience are not what does the causal efficacy. Sure, the mental state, you could just disjoin all the possible physical realizers, if you could ever figure out what they are, because the possibilities are limitless. But if you ever figure out what they are and you disjoin them all, then that would do it. It's just, that wouldn't really be a neuroscientific kind anymore.
But it happened to be, it happened to be a very simple mental state that maybe didn't get, wasn't as plastic or something like that.
Oh, you mean if the kind that corresponded to fear really did turn out to be a simple neural kind?
So maybe another way...
That's possible. It's just all the science that looks like that's not what happens. I mean, think of the two amygdalas. Because you got it over here, you got it over there.
But so say that it just so happened that we didn't have two amygdalas and our brains weren't plastic in this way. Would we then not be responsible for our actions?
That's a good question. I don't know. I'm more worried about us. I would have to think... I mean, it wouldn't just be the two halves. It would have to be, this view of science that I said was the right one. Like,
all the 5 points were just there. Didn't hold.
Yeah, if none of them held, would the person still be responsible? I have to think that one through. That's a good question. But let me go on. We'll have a lot more time for questions.
Okay, just a response to that. If things were like that, then you'd have reductive physicalism. So
yeah.
Kim's causal exclusion argument wouldn't be a problem.
Yeah, that's right. So that's interesting. Maybe you would have reductive if there was no other grounds for. Yeah. Okay, I think the real problem for this view, which is, as I said, the common view, lots of people, Yablow, Peter Menzies, Christian List, have all argued for a similar view. The problem is that what it does is it says that this mental state, right, causes the physical state. But what about this physical state? Does it cause it? Well, now there's downward exclusion. This causing that excludes this causing that, unless there's overdetermination. And they don't really face that problem. And I think they should. Because the physical cause, once you've got the mental causing the physical cause has to be either another cause alongside the mental cause, which sounds like overdetermination, or it's not a cause at all. But if it's a mental cause, if the physical cause just exists as a cause right alongside the mental cause, then they're both of them, it sounds like overdetermination. And if it's not causing anything, it sounds like closure just got violated because this physical thing doesn't have a physical cause. So how do you get that? That's what I think is the real problem. And to answer that question, we have to say something about what causation is. I'm going to assume, and I can talk about these assumptions later, but I'm just going to work with these assumptions for now, that causation should be understood in terms of dependence and non-backtracking conditionals, a la David Lewis, rather than some kind of transfer of energy model. Because I think that, which I call the pool ball model, just excludes a lot of things. Heating up the balloon made it burst. Well, heat is an average, kinetic molecular energy. And so averages are weird abstract things. And yet we talk about them causing things all the time. Just one example, okay? I'm also going to assume that it's events that are causes, but that they cause only by virtue of certain of their properties and not all of their properties. So if I get a new car, the new car makes my entire family happy, but it makes my wife happy because it was cheap. It makes my son happy because it's red. It makes my daughter happy because it's energy efficient. So it's different properties of the car, but getting that car makes my family happy. And similarly for effects, right? The happiness might take different forms in the different people, and it's going to be different properties of the effect that get caused by different properties of the event. But we still tend to cause the event. Say the event is the cause of the effect, which is also an event, even though it causes it by virtue of certain properties of that cause, and it causes certain properties of that effect. This is just Donald Davidson, okay? Only thing that's new is to introduce contrastive causation. So most people think of causation as a two-place predicate that a certain event causes another event, or some people would say a certain property causes another property. I want to think of causation following Schaffer and Menzies and others. I want to think of causation as a four-place relation. C rather than C star causes E rather than E star. What causes it to rain? Well, it's the humidity that causes it to rain. No. It's the high humidity as opposed to the low humidity that causes rain is supposed to stay dry, but it's the temperature being above freezing as opposed to below freezing that causes rain as opposed to snow. And so if you really want to know what causes, the event that really occurred, which is it rained, you have to know what you're contrasting with, because different contrasts are going to have different causes. And similarly, different effects are going to have, they're contrasts on both sides. So why do we need this? Well, let's suppose Jane is a moderate smoker. These are examples from Jonathan Schaffer's paper, Contrastive Causation, Phil Review, 2005, I think. Did Jane's moderate smoking, she's a moderate smoker and gets cancer. Now, did her moderate smoking cause her cancer? Well, the fact that she smoked moderately as opposed to not at all caused her to get cancer as opposed to not at all. But the fact that she smoked moderately as opposed to immoderately, a lot, doesn't cause her cancer, because she would have gotten cancer even if she smoked a lot. Okay? So if she would have gotten cancer if she smoked more, but would not have gotten cancer if she didn't smoke any, you don't know whether to say her moderate smoking caused her cancer, because the fact that she smoked caused it, but the fact that it was moderate as opposed to extreme didn't cause it. And that's captured by different contrast classes. Similarly, Jim has been poisoned, and Dr. Karen gives him an antidote. If he had not gotten the antidote, he would have died today. If with the antidote, he lives for a week, did Dr. Karen cause him to die in a week? Oh my God, who would want to be a doctor if you went around causing people to die in a week? But in fact, obviously the answer is she caused him a week as opposed to a day, whereas the poison caused him to die today instead of not dying at all. Right? You have to put the contrasts in to avoid paradoxes in these types of examples. That's the argument for a contrasted view of causation. Okay? Now let's apply it to the mental case. Mickey, we're talking Mickey Mantle here. And again, I apologize. I was going to change this to cricket or something that, you know, but it's baseball, okay? I hope people will be able to follow despite the fact that it's baseball. Mickey guesses that the pitch will be low and outside, right? Low and outside as opposed to high and inside because you swing very different ways depending on what you expect the pitch to be. He guesses it's going to be that way, so he chooses to swing low and outside, and he hits a home run into the first tier of the stands beyond the outfield. Okay? Now, notice that the mental event, M, of choosing to swing low and outside could have been realized in any one of these three physical events, P1, P2, P3, is what I'm imagining. Those could be, for example, different firing rates of different neurons in the cerebrum. And so no matter which one of those does, he's going to hit a home run. But if the first one does, then he's going to hit into the first tier because not quite as many neurons firing, so the muscles don't go quite as strongly. P2, second tier. P3, the third tier. And none of that's operating consciously. Whether he hits it into the first, second, or third tier, it's not something he's thinking about. He just wants to hit a home run. He's choosing to swing outside, slow and outside, in order to hit a home run. Maybe he doesn't care. Maybe he does, but maybe he doesn't care about which tier it's in. So what do we have here? We have, everybody got that? But then if different neural firings had gone, right, then he wouldn't have hit a home run at all, right? Because maybe he would have swung a little bit too low and that would have popped the ball up and he would have been out. Everybody got the picture? Okay? So if Mickey had not chosen to swing low and outside, but had chosen to swing high and inside, he would not have hit a home run. If he had chosen to swing low and outside, then he would have hit a home run given his skill and the circumstances. I mean, obviously, if a bird had flown in the way or something like that, it wouldn't have happened, but in the circumstances, in the nearby worlds, right? So it's the mental state, that choice to swing low and outside, and that guess that the ball is going to be low and outside, as opposed to an alternative guess and an alternative choice that causes him to hit a home run as opposed to fly out. Okay? Right? Because that's just looking back here at the, you know, whenever he gets the mental event, he gets a home run. Physical. The neural state had not occurred, but another neural realizer had occurred. So instead of P1, P2, or P3, now again, we want the nearest possible world, so we're talking about he still anticipates low and outside, but slightly different neurons fire. Another neural realizer did occur, then he still would have hit a home run. So the neural state, as opposed to other neural realizers of his choice, do not cause him to hit a home run instead of flying out. That's not what causes him to hit a home run as opposed to flying out. P1 is not, right? This neural state, this particular neural state, I should have put. Okay? But if the neural state P1 had not occurred, but another realizer of the choice did occur, then he would not have hit it in the first tier, he would have hit it in the second or third tier. And if the neural state P1 had occurred, then in the circumstances, Mickey would have hit it in the first tier, right? Because, let me see if we go back here, I should have put, there, right? As long as it's P1, he's going to get it in the first tier, P2, he's going to get it in the second tier, P3, he's going to get it in the third tier, okay? So, that particular neural state, as opposed to the other neurorealizers of the same mental state, Mickey's choice, does cause Mickey to hit it into the first tier as opposed to the second or the third tier. This is all a new way of thinking about causation, but I hope you're getting the idea of how this works. because it's crucial. What it means is you can have double causation without any redundancy, because there's both a mental and a physical cause of Mickey hitting a home run into the first tier of the stands. Right? The mental cause makes it a home run as opposed to a fly out. The physical cause, P1, makes it a first tier as opposed to the second tier. And you can have both of them, but it's not redundant. It's not overdetermination, because they're relative to different contrasts. They have different informational content. Okay? Similarly, you can keep closure. Every physical event has a physical cause, just not relative to every contrast. Every physical event has a physical cause relative to some contrast, even if it has a mental cause relative to a different contrast. So you get double causation without redundancy or overdetermination. And a similar story could be told about physical to mental causation. Actually, given the time, and you usually break it at 5:30, I think what I'm going to do is I'm just going to skip the questions here, and you can ask them at the beginning. And I'm just going to say that I'd also be happy to talk about another application I mentioned, that this theory of causation as contrastive and level dependent will also explain group causation, because when a group acts, you also have different instantiations of the group act. Let's just take one of them quickly, and I'll mention it, and then if people have questions, we can come back to it. Suppose 70 of the legislators, instead of 50 voting for the bill, caused the bill to pass instead of failing. I could have put 40 or whatever. So there are 100. It's got to be a majority. 50's not a majority. It's a tie. And so 70 instead of 50 caused the bill to pass instead of failing. But the fact that this 70, these are the ones who did it. It doesn't matter which 70 the bill is going to pass. But this 70 is what causes the Republicans to get blamed instead of the Democrats, or the Democrats to get blamed instead of the Republicans. Right? So it's the particular ones that have one effect relative to one contrast, different effect, different contrast in the two cases. So in the group case, you get exactly the same pattern, and there are other cases as well that we mentioned before. So my conclusion is that contrastivism about causation makes sense of causation by both minds and groups, and those causal relations can allow both minds and groups to be morally responsibility. No, what I meant was morally responsible. Sorry about that. And notice they also pinpoint what the minds and groups are responsible for, because they're responsible for the things that they're relevant to causing as opposed to the other things. And that's going to, as shown by Schaffer in a paper on legal causation, really help pinpoint exactly when they're responsible and what they're responsible for. I'm just looking at the metaphysics of it, and I think this helps you get the metaphysics straight in a way that makes sense out of moral responsibility. So I'll just say thank you at this point, and now we take a break. Is that how it goes?
Yep. Sure.